Blog Talk Radio.
Time away the hour, conferring with the flower, consulting with the rain. And my head might be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
With the thoughts you'd be thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain.
Oh, I tell you why, the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thought before, and then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a number, my head all full of stuffing, my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a king of dairy if I only had a brain.
If you only had a brain, well, you know, you might be able to get a little bit of brains if you listen to Ray McGovern tonight. Yes, former senior CIA analyst in the business, the analysis of intelligence gathering. For over 27 years, Ray McGovern worked with the CIA, giving the presidential briefs to George H.W. Bush, Papa Bush, or supervising it being issued every day, the Presidential Daily Briefs, the PDBs. What he has to say about the seven former directors of the CIA and trying to stop the torture investigation by Attorney General Eric Holder is quite illuminating. I can't wait to play it. I'm going to play it here in just a few minutes. I'd like to remind you that tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. at the Riverfront Park in Lawrence, Kansas, the Kansas Sierra Club, as well as a coalition of other environmental groups, are going to be holding a press conference to launch a campaign to stop coal. That's at the Riverfront Park, beginning at 11 a.m. And let's see, I'll give you some contact information here. Also coming up, October 16th, John Brown Memorial in Kansas City, Kansas. There'll be a gathering to commemorate 150 years of John Brown, since John Brown was in Kansas. I'll give you more details of that on the second half, in the second hour. The Beyond Coal campaign by the Kansas Sierra Club. It's part of a coalition. On September 29th, dozens of events will be organized across the country. Demonstrate strong support for cleaning up the coal industry's contributions to global warming, air pollution, and water pollution. The press conference will be held at 11 a.m. Here's the Riverfront. The Riverfront Park in Lawrence is, take the main entrance at the junction of Highway 2440 and 59. Also, it's the intersection of North 2nd Street and Highways 24 and 40. Public parking is available. The park entrance is marked with a blue sign. Drive straight over the levee through the gates. Park at the designated public parking area. Look for us in the grassy area in front of the river. If you need directions or more information, in case there's an alternative location with unfavorable weather, you can contact Stephanie Cole at sierraclub.org. That's Stephanie, S-T-E-P-H-A-N-I-E, Cole, .Cole, C-O-L-E, at sierraclub.org or phone area code 402-984-1122. Again, that's area code 402-984-1122. Programming notes, this upcoming Wednesday on Radio Free Kansas, we'll be having a full hour of Dave Lindorf, financial writer for Business Week, contributing many, many links to the Flyers daily news ticker. Dave Lindorf talking about the economy. That's the first hour of next Wednesday's, this coming Wednesday's, Radio Free Kansas. Also, we'll have I'm happy to announce, we'll have our Friday Free-for-All, all you callers, Friday Free-for-All, a caller-driven show on Friday. You're welcome to call in. We might take callers in the second hour of tonight, area code 646-716-8652. However, I do plan on broadcasting some of the latest from Honduras. I don't know if you know it. If you haven't been to the Flyer news ticker, you need to go there. That's the Fighting Cock Flyer. Just Google. You know how to Google the Fighting Cock Flyer. Contributing editor Dave Davis is keeping us up to date. It's almost minute by minute. The changing circumstances around the Brazilian embassy where ousted President Mel Zelaya has been held up from regaining his rightful seat as president, democratically elected president of Honduras. Very interesting second hour. We'll have actual phone calls from the embassy. It was recorded. It was broadcast September 25th, just a few days ago. September 25th. There's actually phone calls from journalists within the embassy, as well as an exclusive interview for Flashpoint with President Mel Zelaya. So this is we've got an interesting show tonight. No callers, please, till the second hour, and I'll let you know when you can. And you will have to keep your calls short because best of Flashpoints takes place, runs almost an hour, so we won't have much time tonight. But I do hope you enjoy this interview with Ray McGovern. You'll enjoy it. It runs a full hour. Learn a lot about the CIA and the directors that have ran it. His former bosses, I guess the President of the United States was his main boss, obedient to the Constitution. However, the directors, the history of the directors is quite interesting. Here we go with Ray McGovern, recorded this just yesterday, Sunday. Listeners, for the fourth time, we are privileged to have the presence of Ray McGovern, 27 years, a senior CIA analyst, who some of you may be familiar if you're regular listeners. Ray McGovern writes regularly from Consortium News. His pieces appear all over the Internet, but I always want to direct your attention to Bob Perry's Consortium News because that's where they seem to first come out. Ray McGovern, thank you again for coming on Radio Free Kansas.
You're most welcome, Mike.
You know, your last piece, which is at the top of the scroll at the flyer, folks, that's linked there. Your most recent piece, Mr. McGovern, is about the seven directors, the letter written to President Obama last week urging him to, I guess, put on the brakes on this investigation on possible war crimes committed. What are your thoughts of that? You worked under some of these directors.
I worked under some of them, yes. Well, it's quite remarkable. Here we have seven previous CIA directors, three of whom would be called, in a legal sense, subjects of interest, as much as they are demonstrably accountable for planning and conducting things like torture and assassination and illegal eavesdropping without a court warrant, you know, little things like that. And so here these three enlist the help of four predecessors in writing to the president and saying in a sort of condescending and also threatening way, you better call off this Attorney General Holder guy. I mean, he's not doing anybody a service by pursuing these investigations. And, you know, we really want you to know that this is beyond the pale, and you better stop it. Now, you know, I've seen a lot in my 46 years in Washington. But, and you know, intelligence officers don't like to admit being surprised. And I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised, but I am. My goodness, you know.
Well, seven of them.
And you know what it really shows, the bottom line, in a general sense, it shows why the CIA has reached its nadir, you know, N-A-D-I-R.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, never has the agency been such shambles. And it's directly attributable to these seven unprincipled directors. You'll notice that Admiral Stansfield Turner, who's the director under Jimmy Carter, refused to sign this thing, and that's very much to his credit. But everyone else went along with it. Bill Casey, were he alive, would have insisted that his name go on top of the list, as would Bobby Gates, who's now, God help us, defense secretary. Panetta couldn't sign because, you know, he's director. But he's been co-opted by all these folks, and rather than acting as CIA director, he's very much acting as the lawyer, the principal lawyer for CIA. So it's quite an unimaginable threat and throwing down of the gauntlet to Obama and Holder, the Attorney mm-hmm. General, saying, look, we think you better stop this because... Well, just because. And the second shoe dropped yesterday.
What was that?
Well, that was Senator Kit Bond,
mm.
A great devotee of Jack Bauer and exploits of that kind, who announced abruptly that he's pulling out all the Republican investigators, pulling them out of the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation that's supposed to look into CIA methods, CIA interrogation techniques, and so forth, i.e. torture. So what Bond is saying is, look, there's no chance we'll have a bipartisan report here. We're pulling our people out because we don't want these folks to be in any jeopardy. It's really quite remarkable.
He's saying that now, Kit Bond, listeners, you all know he's from our neighboring state, Missouri. I thought these investigators take certain oaths, and that it has nothing to do with partisanship. I get, what is it? He's not going to pay the investigators, or what? How could he order them partisan investigators? That's interesting.
I should have been clear, Mike. Mm-hmm. We're talking about two investigations here.
Ah.
One that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is pursuing through John Durham. John Durham was already at work investigating how it came to be that 92 CIA tapes, videotapes of interrogations, all of a sudden were destroyed. So Durham has been at this for a year and a half. He's got a leg up, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And Holder did was to say, John Durham, we would like you to broaden your investigation into those possible crimes committed by overachieving torturers who even went beyond the very porous and flexible guidelines of the Department of Justice. In
mm-hmm.
other words,
mm-hmm.
Department of Justice says, well, you can only waterboard somebody, six times a day. And these guys overdid it and did it eight times. Wow. So that's the way this thing has been delimited.
I think that's a common misunderstanding that the Holder's investigation, I know it took me a couple reads of different articles, and I did read the PDF file, by the way. It'll be available, listeners, the complete thing. Mr. McGovern repeatedly urges citizens to read that PDF about the DOJ's findings. However, that these people were exceeding even the sadistic rule that were written in memorandum, official memorandum to the Bush White House. Is that right? These people that Holder's talking about investigating are those that exceeded that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the original memo was very clear about, as you inferred, that they had certain guidelines, if you can call that, on how far they could torture people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The investigation, such as it has become,
mm-hmm.
has been widened to include just those folks. In other words, not the folks that waterboarded six times a day,
uh-huh.
I'm using general figures.
Right,
here,
right.
But the people who outdid themselves and did it eight times a day. Now, you know, that's meant to placate folks who have been saying, well, wait a second, if the Justice Department lawyers said it was okay, no matter what kind of mafia-type lawyers they were and mm-hmm. are, then, you know, you shouldn't prosecute these poor slobs down at the end of the line who tortured because they thought it was okay. And what the concern, of course, is, and this comes through in the letter that the seven dwarfs, I call it Panetta and the seven dwarfs, the seven, you know, they are moral dwarfs, let's face it, these CIA directors that have their own records of cover-up and so forth. What they say is that, you know, we're afraid that there's no, let's see if I find the words here, there's no guarantee that the investigation will stop with just these folks who outdid the instructors from the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. That's pretty transparent, because once you pursue something like this, and this is really important, Mike, these aren't, you know, the Lindy Englands of the world. These are not the privates and private first classes of the world, such as in Abu Ghraib, who were court-martialed and put in a slammer. Now, these are guys who will have lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who's paying these lawyers?
Well,
You are.
The taxpayers.
And I am, yeah. So these lawyers will, you know, if these folks become, you know, subjects of the investigation, what they'll do is say, well, you know, my supervisors, A, B, and C, told me it was okay. And then the lawyers from the supervisors, A, B, and C, will say, well, yeah, we have instructions from supervisors C, D, or E, D, and F, or whatever, and it'll go all the way up to Vice President Cheney and President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're afraid of. And I hope I'm not being too hopeful here, but if this thing is done right, it'll have to escalate in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why these folks are really running scared. They have no guarantee that the delimited parameters of the Holder investigation will ever stand close scrutiny, and certainly they won't withstand the importuning of lawyers hired by those who will be gone after in the first instance. So it's really quite remarkable.
Yes, it is. And you know what's remarkable, too, is that Senator Kit Bond here, I think he's announced he's not running for reelection, and he pulls the shenanigans. He's been a gamesman for Bush, the Bush administration, as well as our own Senator Pat Roberts on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Richard D. Myers, another native Kansan. These individuals seem to be, at least Bond, is running front right now to try to... Now, could you clarify what's he trying to do to stonewall or, you know, for lack of better terms, Watergate this situation? What's he's trying to throw a wrench in the works, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is all very carefully orchestrated.
Mm-hmm.
It's as though Dick Cheney is sitting in his office there in McLean, Virginia, drawing the parameters of this incident. all the things that he has said are being brought to fruition now, not only by these seven, the Gang of Seven, let's call them,
yeah.
these seven previous CIA directors, but now Congress. And what Kit Bond has done is to withdraw the Republican staff members that were participating in the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, which is quite separate, of course, from Holder's investigation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Dianne Feinstein had already tried to go the last mile in assuaging the misgivings of Kit Bond and the rest of them by employing, get this, by employing the quintessential fixer. And that quintessential fixer is Warren Rudman of New Hampshire, previous senator, who has a very, very distinct pedigree of covering up things like, for example, Gulf War illness.
Oh.
What most people don't know is that 200,000, mind you, of the 700,000 people we sent to the Gulf War theater are sick, okay? Sick. Many had died. Their applications for redress from the Veterans Administration have been approved. And this is the war that everybody thinks, oh, casualty-less war, we lost 30 or whatever it was.
Gulf War One.
Gulf War One.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that 200,000 out of the 700,000 are sick. Sick why? Well, a mixture of inoculations not fully approved by the FDA, exposure to sarin nerve gas because things were exploded and they were downwind, a whole manner of things. And Warren Rudman, to his great discredit, let himself be employed by the Defense Department to cover that all up for a period of about 3 or 4 years. Now it's all come out. Now it's all been approved. These people are getting benefits. But put yourself in the position of a Gulf War veteran who has nervous symptoms, chronic fatigue, all kinds of unexplained illnesses, and he's got to wait 3 or 4 extra years because Warren Rudman has covered up for the Pentagon. That's the kind of guy that Dianne Feinstein and Leon Panetta appointed to be, guess what, liaison between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA in this investigation that Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is running. And so you already have the archetypical cover-upper in place. Now, what's really bizarre, Mike, and what I don't really know how to figure out, is that that was announced in March. And I only have access to Google. I don't have these fancy kinds of things. But I haven't seen Warren Rudman's name mentioned since that initial announcement in March. And I don't know what's going on there, whether he's still doing it. He's doing so secretly that his name never comes up. But I've asked some journalists to look into it. And none has been able to uncover whether Warren Goodman is in that capacity or not. So just to sum up here, this is the extent to which Dianne Feinstein has gone to placate those Republicans who might have not wanted to have this investigation. And despite all that, here's Kit Bond pulling out of the investigation, saying it's a witch hunt and we'll have nothing to do with it. So ipso facto, the Senate Intelligence Committee, its report, if it ever sees the light of day, will be by its very nature a partisan report that can be disavowed by all the Republicans and can be made out to be some sort of witch hunt, vindictive kind of exercise.
Well, this is like a cover up going beyond the scale of just the tortures and the war crimes committed, even by the guys following the guidelines. this is incredible. I haven't heard a response from the Obama administration yet about this. It's awfully quiet about this, isn't it?
Well, the president, as you probably know, was on all the Sunday talk shows last weekend. And he was asked about this, and he handled it quite well, I thought. He said, I can understand these these previous CIA directors would feel a certain degree of responsibility for the agency that they created. But, you know, we're going to follow the law, and no one is above the law, and we're going to pursue this investigation. You know, kind of a neat little backhanded way of saying, you guys created this mess. It doesn't surprise me in the least that you try to cover it up,
but
we're going ahead with it anyway. So I think he's struck the right tone so far. But, you know, Mike, when all is said and done, this is really, really dangerous stuff. Let me tell you what happened. People have died in the custody of CIA interrogators. They've died in the custody of military interrogators. That's a war crime. That's a war crime under U.S. law. Okay? 18 U.S. Code 2441. The War Crimes Act passed in 1996 by a Republican-dominated Congress. It says that if someone dies in your custody, the penalty for that can go up to and include capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
You can be executed for that. So the stakes could not be higher, okay? And these cats that are sitting up there in Langley at CIA headquarters and elsewhere in the field have one hell of a lot to lose if these investigations go forward. So where is Obama? Where is Holder on all this? Well, we're doing a little memo today, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. And in that memo, we are suggesting strongly to the president and to Holder that they appoint in key positions people in the Secret Service, people in the FBI, who they know are loyal to the Constitution and will discharge their duty to protect the president and the attorney general, because it comes down to that. And that's really serious. And if they proceed with this, and I duly hope they will, because we are a nation of law, they will be vulnerable. They will be in the same kind of danger that John Kennedy faced just before he was himself assassinated.
Well, that's a real. This memo, will you be circulating it anytime soon to the general public?
Yeah, it'll be out tomorrow on consortiumnews.com.
Okay.
And what it is a response to the letter from the Gang of Seven, the directors. I can share a little bit of it right now. It's in draft, but the primary purpose is to dissociate ourselves from those directors and to encourage the president to let the investigation proceed wherever it will. We comment that that we've never really quite seen such a cheeky challenge, you know, to the rule of law, even though we've been around for a long time, some of us for as long as the agency has really been in existence.
Mm.
One of the things, Mike, that people probably don't know is that the CIA Inspector General's investigation, this is horse's mouth, right? Interviewing all the CIA folks, he put that out in the spring of 2004, made it available to the congressional committees, made it available to the attorney general and so forth. Nothing was done. It's 2004. Nothing was done for over 5 years. And on the 24th of August of this year, it was released. That is, 60% of it was released. The other is all blamed out. 40% of the thing is blamed out. Now, I know people who have read the 100%. They describe what is blackened out as barbarous.
It's
bad enough.
Barbarous?
Yeah, barbarous.
Okay.
Like,
oh, barbarian. Oh, barbaric. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Bad enough is the part that we're allowed to read, and I would encourage your listeners to download that, you know, CIA Inspector General report. It's right there on the web. But the other 40% stuff that's been blackened out are just sickening. And this is the word that was used to describe the Attorney General's reaction after having read that report, was, quote, sickened, end quote, at reading it. So I'm pretty sure that this is what motivated him to go ahead and face into this kind of opposition and this kind of danger, frankly, and go ahead and authorize John Durham, the investigator who was already looking at the destruction of the CIA tapes of investigation of interrogations, to authorize him to broaden that to these other infractions that are clearly beyond even the bizarre parameters of the Department of Justice lawyers. Now, so I guess the bottom line is it's no wonder at all that the knives are out. It's really despicable, in my view, is that people like Kit Bond, you know, they're not so much caring about whether a nation tortures or not. What they're caring about is protecting those like Kit Bond who are informed about these things beforehand and making sure that a Republican president, Bush, and Vice President Cheney, are not dragged further through the slime that is every bit their due. So we have these seven previous CIA directors, three of them, the most recent ones, George Tenet, Porter Goss, and Michael Hayden, with an awful lot to lose from an investigation of this kind. I mean, George Tenet's crimes are legion, falsifying substantive intelligence to deceive Congress into approving an unnecessary war. That's just one of them. The others have to do with torture, kidnapping people, putting them in black holes and not telling their wives their children, much less the cross, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Porter Goss, what about him? Well, he's the guy that was really interested in assassinations. And he's the fellow that has now come out, had these people working on how to assassinate people, despite the rules against it, the executive order approved by Jerry Ford, for example. And Michael Hayden, what about him? Well, Michael Hayden was head of the National Security Agency.
Before he became the director.
Correct, yeah. And he was head of the NSA at 9/11. NSA had information that if it were properly disseminated to the CIA and others, that could have surely prevented 9/11. That's a matter of public record. So he was, when 9/11 happened, the president went to him and said the same thing that he said to George Tenet. Look, I know you're embarrassed. I know you really blew it. But I need your help here, and I'll keep you in place. I'll even promote you if you play the game. And the game for Michael Hayden was simply this. I want to monitor Americans. I want to monitor Americans without a court warrant. I know that it's the law. But I want you to do it. Will you do it, Michael Hayden? Now, Hayden was asked by Kit Bond, okay?
Oh, really?
He was asked by Kit Bond at his confirmation hearings. It was one of these canned questions, you know. It was supposed to be a softball that he'd knock over the fence. Kit Bond said, "Now, General Hayden, when the President of the United States asked you to monitor these conversations and told you that he wanted you to do this, was this a difficult decision for you?" And the answer that was scripted was, "Of course not. The President of the United States asked me to do this. He said, it's all right. I'm going to do it." But no. You know, what does Michael Hayden do? I was watching the thing, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing. You got to look it up. What he does is this. He pauses, and he gulps, and he swallows, and he says, "Well, you know, that was really, really a very difficult decision for me." And then he goes on for a while, and he says, "You know, I toyed with it. I puzzled over it. And then in the final analysis, I decided that I could not do it." Do what? Violate what had always been since 1978, the first commandment of the National Security Agency: thou shalt not eavesdrop on American citizens without a court warrant. End quote. I mean, that was the first commandment. All of his all of his people were indoctrinated into that, and so were we in the CIA. As a matter of fact, when we got an intercepted message that had an American citizen's name in it, we got it not blackened out, mind you, Mike. We got it razored out, okay? There was no way we could find out what the name of that American citizen was, and that's the way the law is. And so what Michael Hayden was asked to do was to violate all that. And when I asked, you know, senior NSA officials who were in place at the time, how do you get away with that? How do you possibly get away with that? They say, well, you know, the need to know, you can circumscribe knowledge of this in a handful of people sworn to do what you tell them to do. You can get your general counsel, a guy named Dietz, to give you an opinion. And interestingly enough, Hayden admitted that Dietz wouldn't give him a written opinion. He wouldn't give him a written opinion on it. And so he just went on the oral opinion. Okay, that's the kind of guy Michael Hayden is. So you can imagine him sitting around here wondering, well, they'll go after the slobs that did too much waterboarding, but, you know, they could easily get to me as well before they're finished. And so he is one of the moving forces, he and Vice President Cheney, behind this egregious letter from the Gang of Seven.
They sit around, and that's three of the seven, Hayden, Porter Goss, who interestingly just disappeared off the radar screen and after his director, and Tenet, who was Clinton's original. Clinton brought him in, I believe. Yeah. And now he got these three topside.
Yeah, I didn't say anything about Goss, but, you know, he's the fellow that I guess I did mention that the assassination schemes got new energy. But he's also the guy that brought in the famous Dusty Fago. Okay, now who's Dusty Fago?
Yeah.
Dusty Fago was a middle-level logistics officer overseas working for the CIA. And somehow he ingratiated himself with Porter Goss, and he became number three. When Porter Goss came over to the agency, he became the executive director. Where is he now? He's sitting in jail. Sitting in jail because he steered contracts to his old buddies and did other nefarious things. And that's the kind of guy that Porter Goss put in senior positions. And, of course, he was a disaster for the agency. And when Fago got wrapped up and other information came out about these famous parties with Duke Cunningham, the representative from California.
Yeah.
All this other stuff. All of a sudden...
poker games and escort services and all.
Right, yeah. So I don't know how much of that is true, but certainly part of that was involved, was named in all that. And all of a sudden, he's gone. He resigns without any experience at all. Okay, so that's Porter. Let me say a couple words about these other guys.
Yeah,
the four that were induced to come in here and also sign this letter. Well, let me start with James Schlesinger. Okay, now this he was called Big Jim. Okay.
Yeah.
Now when was he imposed on the CIA? It was 1973 when Nixon was in real, real trouble. And when Jim Schlesinger came into the CIA, he gathered his principal, very senior people around. I was not that senior at the time, but we got the immediate report. What he said was, look, one overarching aim in my being here, and that is to make sure that you don't screw Richard Nixon. And let me just tell you a sort of proof of that, that I'm not reporting to Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor, which is the normal procedure for a CIA director. I'm reporting to Bob Haldeman.
Oh,
so you guys watch yourselves, and especially you Soviet analysts. I want you to get in line here. Realize what a terrible threat the Soviets are. Now, this is just a decade before they fell apart. So that was Schlesinger, okay? And so he was there to cover up Watergate, frankly. And what most people don't remember what I do. John McCord, remember?
Yeah.
The poor little guy who was one of the guys that broke into the Watergate.
Yeah, one of the plumbers, the burglar unit that went
in. Exactly, yeah.
Went in.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, he went in. He was one of the actual operatives that went in. Into the Watergate Hotel. Yes.
Yeah, he was, a witness of the CIA. He was one of the plumbers. And, of course, he was what the investigators on Watergate did to start with a small fry and work their way up. I think he did a pretty effective thing. Anyhow, McCord was under all kinds of legal pressure. And all of a sudden, he's met in a hotel room in Boston and importuned to make sure that he would say, well, he really was working for the CIA, and the CIA was really behind the Watergate break-in, okay? Now, McCord answers this way. He says, look, he said, you guys already tried that, but Dick Helms, the director, is not going to allow it. And guess what? His interlocutor slapped down a copy of the Boston Globe, the headline of which that particular day was, James Schlesinger to become new CIA director, Helms out.
Wow.
And his interlocutor said, Mr. McCord, we have reason to believe that the new CIA director will play along with this game. Now, that's a matter of record. That's testimony by John McCord. That's the kind of guy Schlesinger was and is. Let's take William Webster.
Yeah.
What about him? Well, he's Judge Webster, right? He was a judge. He was head of the FBI.
Yeah, for a while.
And now he's head of the CIA. And what happens? What happens is Iran-Contra.
Oh.
Okay. Now, what does Webster do with respect to Iran-Contra? Well, as CIA director, he helps to sabotage the Iran-Contra investigation. How? By withholding key information to protect some of the CIA operatives involved. That's a matter of record. That's very clear. And without that kind of information, it was impossible for Investigator Walsh, Special Prosecutor Walsh, or the Iran-Contra Committee to proceed. And that thing just fizzled out, largely because Judge Webster saw it as his duty to sabotage the Iran-Contra affair. So here you have two known expert cover-uppers.
Yeah.
How about John Deutsch? He's number three of the four. Well, John Deutsch, let me try to restrain myself here. His cover-up efforts were as unconscionable as they come, okay? And they're very little known.
Yeah.
What did he do? He led a concerted effort, successful for several years, to cover up the exposure of U.S. troops to toxic chemicals during the Gulf War of 1991. As I may have mentioned, over 200,000 of the 700,000 troops in the theater remain ill 18 years after 1991. Many are dead, and only recently was it acknowledged that their illnesses are directly due to their service over there. So what John Deutsch did, with the help of Warren Rudman, was to delay the truth coming out for a period of 4 or 5 years while all these poor veterans in the Gulf War were suffering from undiagnosed illnesses, loosely called Gulf War illnesses, which were not judged to be reimbursable or judged to be the kinds of illnesses that would put them on disability.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as bad as it gets. Well, maybe not. James Woolsey.
Now that's...
I tell you, if you're wondering what happened to the CIA, you think about these seven guys, and then you wonder why it can do some honest work at all. Here's James Woolsey. Well, he was a neocon to placate the Republicans by Bill Clinton, who thought he was bright enough to, bring all these folks in. Well, after he named James Woolsey to be head of the CIA, he refused to see him. Wolsey never got any FaceTime with Clinton.
Really?
In fact, yeah, Wolsey himself jokes about how little FaceTime he had with Clinton. At one point during Wolsey's tenure, this little Cessna plane that made a crash landing on the
lawn of the White House.
Yeah, right. And the joke going around Washington in which Wolsey participated was, that was Wolsey trying to see the president.
That's a lot of truth to that. Oh, sure. You know, he's sort of an aficionado. I don't know how to call a guy like scarves and sports cars from all. I can't tell, but that's true. I guess Clinton brought him in and Woosley just sort of just let it go. He just sort of like, I'm director and I don't have to. Well, it seems to be, you know, there was a thing you recounted. There's two things I'd like you to help.
Well, Mike, let me
go ahead.
Finish.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
There's more.
Sure. Well, okay. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, I think your reader, your listeners and readers probably would want to know what else he did, because he made a mockery of directing the CIA and years for a disaster. But after he left, wow, then he really overachieved as, quote, the former CIA director, Jim Woolsey, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was on, I was on a talk show with Woolsey back about 4 or 5 years ago, a late night fellow from North Carolina, good guy.
Mm-hmm.
The name will occur to me. Anyhow, we had this little debate, and he was trying to tell me, as late as then, that, the British really believed that Saddam Hussein was getting yellowcake uranium from Niger. It was really so pathetic, because I was just in London. Well, you know, and then I happened to Israel in connection with U.S. motivation in going into Iraq, and it was really bizarre, because he looked at me and he said, oh, you're anti-Semitic.
Oh.
And I said to the moderator, I said, hey, time out here. What's going on here? I mentioned Israel in connection with U.S. motivation, and I'm anti-Semitic. And Woolsey said, well, what you said was anti-Semitic. And, I was glad that he lost it, because it was very clear to the whole audience. Charlie Rose is the name I was trying to
say. Oh, my goodness, yeah. Uh-huh.
It was clear to everyone watching Charlie Rose that night what the game was. Never was it more clear what he was trying to do. And, this is the fellow, who describes himself as the, he's often asked whether he's Jewish because he's so much a part of the Israel lobby or the food lobby. And he says, no, I'm the anchor of the Presbyterian wing of JINSA. JINSA is the Jewish National Security Association. Okay, and it's sort of like APAC. So he brags about being the anchor of the Presbyterian wing of JINSA, and so here he's calling me anti-Semitic. Anyhow, here's what James Woolsey did after he stopped being director and became, quote, former CIA director. Well, he helped create the spurious, quote, intelligence, end quote, to justify the war in Iraq. Do you remember Curveball?
Oh, in the book, yeah, right, yeah.
Curveball was the guy who gave us all that great information on mobile biological weapons laboratories.
Right? Plan of Attack by Bob Woodward, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
And remember how Colin Powell couldn't show the photos of the biological weapons laboratories, but sure, he showed some artists' renderings of same. That was the big evidence there at the UN on the 5th of February, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And that was largely due to Woolsey's ginning up that information and getting Curveball a hearing, not with the CIA, because he couldn't trust the CIA to be as dishonest as that, but with the Defense Department. The other thing that brings him further disrepute is that he had a big hand in this yellow cake uranium. Remember the charade that that Iraq was going to get yellow cake uranium from Niger and transport it to Iraq where they didn't need it because they already had more yellow cake that they could refine to a pure state. And, you know, it was a charade that couldn't be true. And yet he helped to create it. And as of his interview with me on Charlie Rose, he was still saying that those famous 16 words, remember, in George Bush's State of the Union address in 2003? Yeah. This is what Bush was prompted to say by the likes of Woolsey, quote, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa," end quote. Well, that's the piece that Ambassador Joe Wilson thought beyond the pale, and we know that story.
He bravely wrote up an op-ed piece, and it was published in one of the Washington Post, I think.
The New York Times.
New York Times, yeah. And
the title was "What I Didn't Find in Niger."
And then it went on, and then it just started a whole smear job and hit job that eventually cost his wife a career in the CIA. It was a horrible chapter.
So these guys mean business.
Yeah.
But anyhow, those are the pedigrees of the four other directors, not the ones that are already subject to these investigations, but the ones that were enlisted to buttress their case that there should be no investigation. So it's really quite amazing kind of thing here. You got experts in cover-ups suggesting further cover-up by this administration.
Well, things I wanted to, you go quite a ways back. I don't know what you were doing when Stanfield Turner was there, but he and Jimmy Carter did some. I guess they fired they fired a lot of members of the CIA or something. There was some cleaning house that went on. I think this might have been before or after the Church Committee, but in your most recent piece that you wrote, that's at the top of the flyer, folks. You mentioned I believe it's that piece, that you mentioned an interesting part about, I think it was when Helms ran over the coals at the Church Committee, and they came back to one of the cafeterias or something. Could you tell us a little bit? And could you finish up, help us explain why you, after 27 years of work with these, could you explain to us the structure of why the, you know, what about the CIA, you probably write a book on that. I should be more specific. What are the divisions of the CIA that you think, if there is anything redeeming to be saved, could you tell us about the difference between covert operations and the analysts? I think that those are two things.
Well, Mike, as usual, you kind of hit the nail on the head here. In order to understand any of this, and specifically in order to understand why I can say these things and insist on saying these things.
Yeah.
Bravely, understand.
And bravely you say these things.
No big deal for me. You know, I'm not running for office and I don't need any money. And, you know, it's nice to be in this position. Anyhow, what happened was this. We end up with two CIAs. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the original CIA, envisaged by President Truman, was a place which would have access to all the information on a given country or issue, unlike the situation that obtained before Pearl Harbor, when you had little bits and pieces of information, you know, available to the code breakers, or the embassy in Tokyo, the FBI here in Washington, the Navy, the Army Air Corps, all that kind of stuff.
And half of them didn't talk to each other. Yes, right.
Yeah,
right.
No one in one central place to put it all together and be responsible for reporting that to the president. So that was the whole thing. He wanted that to happen, and he also wanted this body of experts not to be subordinate to the Pentagon or the State Department. In other words, his own independent read. He wanted to go to the head of the CIA in Virginia and say, "Look, Mr. Director, I want you to tell me what you and those two universities' worth of specialists out there in the woods of Virginia, I want to know what you really think about this. I don't care what the State Department says. I don't care what the Defense Department says. I want to know what you guys really think." Now, that was the CIA that I... and almost always we could speak without fear or favor. It depended on the integrity and the courage of the head of the CIA, but most often we encountered freewheeling in telling the president, for example, President Johnson, you know, those blue-suited Air Force guys are telling you that if we bomb the hell out of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that we can end the war and Ho Chi Minh will give up. Not so, Mr. President. Number one, Ho Chi Minh Trail doesn't look anything like I-95,
right,
I-81, or I-66. You can't even see it from the air, for God's sake. It's about 150 trails. We'll never be able to interdict that. And besides, bombing a country like North Vietnam will simply enhance their resistance. And so, you know, it's not a good idea, we think. Well, Johnson just didn't want to be the first president to lose a war, so he said, well, what the heck, you know, maybe CIA is wrong. So presidents are not bound to adhere to our advice.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. They never thought of inserting, you know, 100,000 more troops or anything like that without requesting a formal national intelligence estimate from us, and we're proud of the record that we created in those days, even though BJ didn't keep it.
Yeah, he didn't follow it, but at least he presented it. Yeah.
So now that's the agency that Truman wanted. Now, what happened? Well, after World War II, these very heroic, very imaginative and enterprising OSS, Office of Strategic Services people, these were the real spies. You know, the people who dropped in behind enemy mm-hmm. lines in Norway and France and out the Far East actually brought Ho Chi Minh into Hanoi when the Japanese were driven out. So these were the folks that really performed miracles and deserved all the accolades they got when they got back to Washington in 1946-47. And they said, okay, thanks a lot, but do you still need us? These were the covert action people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Soviet Union is just going to Eastern Europe, just threatening the Balkans, Italy, France. The KGB was all around the world. The question answered itself. Do we need you? Of course we need you.
Yeah.
And then some idiot, I use the word advisedly, idiot, Mike, said, hey, we're creating this other agency. That's going to be secret. This is secret. So let's put these operators in with the CIA that we're creating. And despite the objections of the analytic people who saw what danger this would cause in terms of creating a two-headed monster, one sentence was included in the National Security Act of 1947, which reads as follows. The Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to national security that the President of the United States shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Now, what does that do? One sentence. What does it do? Well, depending on who the President is and what kind of character he has or lacks, what kind of integrity or what kind of respect for the law he has or lacks, that President can use the CIA as his own personal Gestapo. And I use that word advisedly.
Yes, you have.
The only check on that, Mike, are the oversight committees in the Congress, and as is well known, the last 8 years, those oversight committees were overlooked committees, and so when the President ordered George Tenet, a fellow who thought his reason for being was to do whatever the President said, when he said, George, we want you to torture these folks, and here's the opinions that allows you to do that, George salutes, and he goes out, and he does it. That's the operational part of the agency. It has no business being in with an analytic core. And President Truman, before he died, in an op-ed in 1963, said so. He said, I'm pleased. Here this agency is overthrowing governments.
Yeah.
It's engaged in all kinds of covert action. That's not what I had in mind. That should be lopped off. And it should be lopped off in a... These events, the torture, kidnapping, and all that stuff, if that doesn't persuade the American body politic to lop that part off, I don't care if you put it in the Defense Department or you abolish it altogether. Lop it off so the CIA analysts can do their job. One last thing here, Mike.
That was by Harry Truman.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a seldom known letter. I'll tell you that
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, it's an op-ed, December 22nd, 1964? 63. Yeah. Yeah. So the last thing, I was going to say one more thing.
Sure.
Here, but it escapes me at the moment, so fire away.
Well, the next thing, I was listening to your interview on Brad Friedman's Brad blog, which I played that segment a couple times, about your referencing, I think it's his name's James Douglas, I think it's the book about the JFK, what was it, the book, that you
JFK,
mentioned.
JFK and the Unspeakable.
And the Unspeakable. You mentioned there's a possibility that President Obama and Eric Holder, for lack of better terms, in Kansas, should be watching his back. They should be watching their backs.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to have to say this, but not only do we have the present set of circumstances that I've tried to describe this morning, but we also have this precedent. And if you look at what happened to John Kennedy, and this is incredibly well documented in James Douglas's study here. Douglas is with two S's, by the way.
Yes.
And it's available on Amazon or wherever.
One of my neighbors, I've just finished the book myself, Ray, off your prompting. It is an amazing book, yes.
Well, I'm not even finished with it, but everyone I know whose opinion I respect, and myself, I'm up to page like 300. I'm very impressed by the meticulousness of his research, and the fact that he had access to more recently released documents and interviews than any other investigator of JFK's demise. And so, my bottom line is this: Douglas makes a very persuasive case that the super patriots, who among the military wanted to do a first strike on the Soviet Union, rather than work out something where we could have a modus vivendi, and the CIA Knicks, who were hell-bent on destroying Fidel Castro, were appalled at Kennedy's denial of air cover for the Bay of Pigs invasion, even though he never promised it, were appalled at the Test Ban Treaty, and were particularly appalled at the notion that President Kennedy had decided to withdraw from Vietnam. You know, Vietnam,
yeah.
The communists were going to take over that whole part of the world, according to some people, that they conspired, between them and the Secret Service people that they suborned, FBI people who kind of looked the other way, they set up this situation where John Kennedy was killed. And there's a wealth of information with respect to how John Kennedy had already ordered the withdrawal of 1,000 troops from Vietnam. And there were only, I think, about 30,000 there at the time. The rest were coming out in another year or so. The military were resisting this mightily, wouldn't even give Secretary McNamara, the defense secretary, plan for doing this, despite being ordered to do that by the president and by McNamara. So the thing holds together. Now, if, you know, fast forward here to today. Here's Obama with a CIA that not only has this ideological bench, at least the operatives do, but has criminal vulnerability. People who can be sentenced to death or
lies in prison,
torture and the murder that occurred in their watch. There's that, and then now there's Afghanistan. You know, instead of Vietnam, the president shows every evidence of saying, "Ooh, what have they suckered me into?"
Yeah, well, he said straight he's going to take weeks to make his mind up on this, and this is after McChrystal recommends 40,000 additional troops into the Afghanistan.
Well, you know, there's one rumor purveyed by Andrea, what's her name, the big commentator there on one of the main networks, and Andrea, anyhow, she said that one of her sources said that the secret part of McChrystal's report says that 500,000, not 20,000, not 40,000, but 500,000 troops would be required to do the job in Afghanistan. It would take at least 5 years. Now, if that's in the report, now if that's accurate, then we have a situation where the president needs to face up to this and say, you know, where are we going to get 500,000 troops? You know, what are the equities here really? Do we need 500,000 troops to capture Bin Laden? Give me a break. And so I see the president facing into this against great pressure, especially from the military and from the Republicans, because who wants to lose a war, right? Who wants to be a president who loses a war? Now, who wants to be a president that can be characterized as soft on terrorism? All that business. So, you know, he's got a lot to contend with, and so I plead for a little patience on the part of us progressives who are more inclined to see a glass half empty rather than glass half full. I think instincts and those of Eric Holder are good. Those of Bobby Gates, not good. Bobby Gates will just bend with the wind. I know that. He used to work for me as an analyst at the CIA. He'll just do what he thinks is the best political move for him, Bobby Gates. So on Afghanistan, to just kind of sum up here, President Obama faces the kind of situation that John Kennedy faced at the end of 1963, just before he was assassinated, when he made clear, against the advice of virtually all his advisors, that he was going to get out of Vietnam. And when someone asked his brother Bobby why that was the case, Bobby slammed his hand down on the desk and said, because we were there, because we saw that. And indeed, he and Bobby toured Vietnam in the 50s, saw the French, their exercise of recouping their influence in Vietnam. So JFK had the right instincts. I think this president, President Barack Obama, has the right instincts. But he's really up against it, the more so since the CIA and others have one heck of a lot to lose if the general pursues this investigation to where he should. The last thing I'll say is this, that the intelligence committees in Senate and House, as we know now, are hopelessly divided, hopelessly politicized. Is there a committee that can do the job? Well, yeah, there is one. As a matter of fact, that committee has already done the job. That's called the Senate Armed Services Committee. And what did they decide? Well, they did a complete investigation of about 18 months, and in December of last year, they issued their findings. Their purview was the military, of course.
And embarrassing as it is, the tape ran out. But he talks about the Senate Armed Services Committees and their findings, and he cites the date there, and I recommend you go back and do that. I will go out of my way and find that memorandum, the result of their investigation and what they recommended. It was cut off, but Mr. McGovern continued for about 3 minutes. What an interesting conversation, huh? We're going to go on now with these late-breaking reports from the surrounded embassy, from within the surrounded embassy, Brazilian embassy in Honduras. Many thanks to Ray McGovern. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry about the last 3 minutes. What a great interview. I enjoyed it.
This week on the Best of Flashpoint, we hear from 4 days of drumbeat coverage from the Honduran capital as President Manuel Zelaya returns to the country. Our special correspondents Tim Russo and Andres Contreras support from inside the Brazilian embassy and out in the streets as Zelaya and his supporters take refuge while Honduran military and police surround and attack the building. We'll also get an exclusive interview from President Zelaya himself. And a new documentary film spotlights the Chevron Texaco destruction of the Ecuadorian rainforest and how indigenous communities are fighting back. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoint. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The Night Report is off tonight. We focus our attention on the bold return of Manuel Zelaya earlier today to Honduras. At midday, in fact, today, 86 days into a coup d'etat in Honduras, President Manuel Zelaya boldly returned to retake the reins of power. 86 days ago, Zelaya was greeted by soldiers wearing masks and taken in his pajamas at gunpoint to the airport and then flown out of the country against his will. Today, in broad daylight, accompanied by United Nations peacekeeping forces, Zelaya re-entered Tegucigalpa and ultimately greeted the people from the top of the Brazilian embassy. Flashpoint special correspondent Tim Russo was on the line earlier today as Zelaya took to the roof and thousands of Hondurans flooded the streets in an unbridled expression of joy and relief. Here is Tim Russo.
Tim Russo in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, surrounded by several thousand exuberant Hondurans that have received news that Manuel Zelaya has been president, constitutionally elected, has returned to Honduras. And we're trying to confirm as much of this information as possible. The thousands of people went into the streets after at the center of Tegucigalpa. The United Nations building was surrowned by huge crowds of people as the world was Zelaya within the United Nations installations there. You have people in the streets that are walking with several thousand are walking from the UN to the Brazilian embassy where they believe that he might actually be. But we do have confirmation from campesino leader Rafael Alegria, Harry Dixon, one of the fiscals, the judiciary fiscals here in Tegucigalpa, that indeed the lion is in the country, but we're not sure in what building or where. So we're in the process of trying to find that out. Again, it's a sense of victory here for the people on the streets. We're hoping that this information for this is true, and we're following this as the story develops, hoping to be among some of the first to actually see the liar and speak to him when he addresses the nation and the capital here later today. We're being tightly monitored by helicopters that are flying overhead, and we've heard of a huge amount of movement at the capital president himself, at the presidential palace, where Mr. Renetti, Roberto Michelletti, the facto president, is believed to still be at the moment. We have not heard or been able to confirm what may have happened with General Romero Vasquez Velasquez involved with the June 28th coup, and we've not seen any other police presence on the street except for one moment when the police tried to set up a security perimeter near the United Nations, and they were officially run off.
And been confirmed that President Zelaya came through the back roads, through the mountains, into Tegucigalpa, back into the country. Tim Russo, we are hearing from Eva Golinger that there was a conversation between Hugo Chavez and Zelaya when Zelaya was actually in the United Nations complex in Tegucigalpa. Had you heard about that?
We were outside of the Iron Nation building for the last couple of hours with the multitude, and it's been very complex to get great information. We did not hear that conversation, but we've been speaking to the Lions Travel Minister and party members that were going in and out of the UN building. Apparently, his wife was also in the building, and we were looking for further confirmation from her, but she did not leave that building.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that was Tim Russo, Flashpoint special correspondent, wonderful journalist who works with Free Speech Radio News, who has been on it for this program all the way through this 86-day military coup. It's still formally in operation, but as you heard, we were there with Tim Russo as President Zelaya confirmed for the people from the roof of the Brazilian embassy that he was back. He had come in and he was back to restore democracy. It was amazing. There was, in fact, dancing in the streets. The streets were flooded with every kind of person. Schools were let out to greet the return of the president. And obviously, this is a story that we have said time and again is crucial to the region and crucial to the world, that this kind of coup could not possibly be allowed to stand in this hemisphere after so much that we've seen over so many years. And we're going to keep the discussion going with somebody who knows a great deal about what's been going on, has been there during the coup, and Al Giordano is the founder and editor at Narco News, monitoring this through the day. I also want to tell everybody that we're going to be attempting to reach different reporters on the ground. We just heard from Andreas Tomas Conteras. He was just with the president. We're trying to make contact there, but it's difficult. The military apparently is somehow screwing with the communication system. Al Giordano, welcome to Flashpoints. This is definitely history, and do we think the president had the nod from the United States to do this?
Well, we don't know, but this has all the markings of a very well-executed and planned operation. That, you know, I mean, when I spent half the summer in Honduras and saw various small airfields, which each of them had a military delegation there and buses and vehicles blocking the runways. They were so afraid and of Zelaya's return, the border checkpoints as well. And so that he got through all that, but it reminds me of the Von Trapp family in The Sound of Music, you know, crossing the mountains to get back into his country. And it makes fools of the coup regime, and it takes away the sheen of invincibility that they've tried to promote. They were caught flat-footed, and that the choice of Brazil's embassy for him to do this with the permission of President Lula, the Brazilian Foreign Minister Celso Amorim personally welcomed Zelaya by phone call to, quote, Brazilian territory when he entered the embassy, and the regime now is trying to figure out how to deal with this. Meanwhile, it calls a curfew this afternoon, and people are disregarding it. They're mocking it. There are thousands already there in front of the embassy to protect their president, and thousands more coming down from the hills, coming in from the different states of the country. One caravan from the state of El Paraíso has already 2,000 vehicles in it, and that's a rather small state. And they're all heading there. The call has gone out in the popular barrios throughout Tegucigalpa for the people to come on down and surround that embassy and protect their legitimate president. Now, what the United States knew or whether it participated in this, we don't know. All we know is that at the State Department press briefing this morning, when reporters asked about it, the U.S. was the first to confirm that, yes, Zelaya is in Honduras, at the very time when Micheletti, the coup regime president, was denying to the press, saying, no, our intelligence says he's not in Honduras. He's at the United Nations in New York. And any press that's saying he is in Honduras is committing terrorism mediatico. No, media terrorism. And of course, so he ends up looking like an even bigger buffoon now that it's all confirmed. And that moment that Tim Russo so heroically documented for us is really a special moment in history.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're speaking with Al Giordano somewhere in the Americas. And he has been monitoring the situation. He has been in the country since the coup in Honduras. And let's just talk a little bit more about that historical significance of no matter how this was engineered, that this victim of a coup, a duly constituted president, is run out, but they never come back.
Well, no regime fears a government in exile. That's what they want. I was talking with the Serbian resistance leader, Ivan Marovic, today about all this, just sort of strategizing the situation, trying to figure out what the next steps of the regime are going to be. And this presents a real problem for them, because he's in Honduras.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the bold return of President Manuel Zelaya to Tegucigalpa, to Honduras, to the Brazilian embassy, and we have been watching the story very closely. And joining us again, first from the Brazilian embassy, is our good friend Andres Contreras. He is with Flashpoints in Espanol, and I'm sorry, he is with Democracy Now! In Espanol, and he is talking to us from the Brazilian embassy. We also have Tim Russo from another location on the ground there in country. Andres, welcome back, and tell us what the situation is now inside the Brazilian embassy with the president.
It's good to be back, Dennis. The situation here has been one in which over the course of the day, there were about 300 people total here in the embassy. Many of them came here for refuge, really, from the political violence. And during the course of the day, the First Lady was able to negotiate their safe passage. And now there are about between 100 and 150 folks here at the embassy. There is a lot of concern about threats made by either directly or indirectly by the regime that there could be an assault. However, very encouraging to hear that the response of the Brazilian government itself, and that they have officially requested an emergency meeting of the Security Council of the United Nations. Apparently, the United States is also part of that request, and we've heard that if U.S. officials have said if there is an attack on this embassy by the de facto regime, the United States would consider it to be an attack against them. So that is somewhat encouraging. Because throughout the day, there was a lot of fear expressed because the property adjacent to the embassy has been taken over by the police, and they are occupying it, and if they wanted to raid this embassy, they could easily do so from that neighboring building.
And now, in terms of the actual lockdown of the Brazilian embassy, so you're saying that the people in are in to stay, nobody's coming and going, and it is, in fact, surrounded by the military and the security forces.
Yes, it is definitely surrounded by the military forces. Visibly, there are usually around 50 soldiers and police, riot police, many of them masked. But what we know is that in the surrounding six-block area, there are hundreds and hundreds of others that are preventing any access to the embassy. Even some journalists have been turned away. And so really is creating an isolation feeling here. And I'm sorry, the first part of your question, Dennis?
Well, I just wanted to know if, in fact, it is locked down and nobody is coming and going.
Yeah, well, they, apart from this negotiated accord that the First Lady made with the police, a bus came here to pick up around 150 who were here, and they have now left. People are free to leave the embassy, but there's been a curfew, so it wouldn't be wise to be leaving, and they have prevented folks from coming here.
Now, let me ask you to just hold on, because I want to know a little bit more about what's been going on inside there, but I think we've got Tim Russo. Tim, are you with us?
Yeah, I am indeed, Dennis.
Tim, where are you now?
I'm just outside of the Colonia Kennedy, where we saw some of the most recent police repression toward back into Pacific March that was taking place by the people of the neighborhood itself. That was organized around 3:30, 4 o'clock this afternoon. The march took off, and at about 5 o'clock, the police came in pretty heavy-handed, as they've been doing throughout the course of the day in neighborhoods, marginalized neighborhoods, around the capital of the city. So we've been following that story throughout the day and trying to follow up on the detentions that have been taking place, including the fact that the police shot several canisters of tear gas into one of the main human rights organizations in Tegucigalpa, COFAL, the Committee of the Families of the Disappeared. That took place very early this morning as people were beginning to take refuge there to denounce what had happened, as they were violently displaced from the streets in front of the embassy, as Andreas just mentioned to us, at early hours of the morning around 5:40. So we've been here following that throughout the day, moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, trying to keep a tally of detentions, trying to keep a tally of those who've been released, and trying to get updated as well of new developments, like the Ian Kelly press statement that was made by the United States in saying that they were urging both Micheletti and Zelaya to immediately sign the San Jose agreement to find an exit, political and diplomatic exit to this situation here in Honduras.
All right. In terms of what do we know about the level of violence? What did you see? What have you been able to note, document, report in terms of the impact of the attacks and how many people were arrested, where they're being held, what we know in terms of the numbers the police are saying they took in as compared to what the human rights activists are saying?
Yes, that's right. The police were saying both this morning and later this afternoon that their official numbers were about 150 people detained throughout the day in Tegucigalpa for either having defied the curfew, which has been reinstated until 6 tomorrow morning, that's been extended, or for being a part of the demonstrations that were in front of the Brazilian embassy or demonstrations in some of the neighborhoods. What human rights organizations, COFADE, seems to coincide with CODE, as well as CIPRODE, the three major independent human rights organizations here in Tegucigalpa, they all come up with a number closer to 350 people that have been detained, with numbers as high as 36 different types of injuries, from broken arms to people that were being beaten at one point with sticks with nails in them by the police. And that doesn't include people that were affected really by tear gas, which are much, much larger numbers. Many people trying to do self-medication to get their breathing back. We saw ourselves several accounts of very old women in their early 80s that had to be carried out of the second floor of a house because the police had shot tear gas through the windows of the house in a marginalized neighborhood there. In that same raid on the marginalized community called Pacho, there was several women that were carrying young babies less than a year old through the streets trying to get away from that burning sensation and the asphyxiating sensation of the tear gas that was very liberally used by the police in order to get people off of the streets or out of the streets. Really, when the people would see journalists in the area, they would become very exuberant to have their voices heard by the world, that they were there expressing their rights to say, we want Mel Zelaya back in the country as our president. And so they had very little fear to the police at that instant. And the police took a very belligerent stance and repressive reaction to that by being very liberal, again, with the amount of tear gas that they were enveloping these colonias in. And this is taking place in, I believe we have documented, at least 8 different colonias, including the 2 largest, Kennedy, which was the most recent, and Ato in Alto.
Were they going after journalists? Did you get, did you come under attack?
A group of journalists that I was with, we became under verbal attack at 2 points during the day. The early point by the police and military that did not want us to reach the Brazilian embassy as we were trying to get there around 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning shortly after the repression took place there. We were told to leave the streets at that point. We came back around, bumped into some of the same officials that recognized us, and finally were able to get authorization from higher-level military and police officials, including the spokesperson to the national police, who stated to us that international and national journalists were free to cover anywhere and move freely, even with the curfew throughout the city, except for the 100 meters that are completely cordoned off in front of the Brazilian embassy. Now, what we saw a second time was later this day at the same scenario that I had mentioned earlier in Picacho, where the police were shooting tear gas at people in the streets there and in their homes. They turned directly towards us and said, let's shoot at those journalists over there. They didn't shoot directly at us, but when we were sort of in the midst of things, we could see that they were directing their tear gas canisters in a very specific direction, more towards us than the crowd, either to get us out of there or to send us a clear message that we're being considered a part of the resistance by putting their voices out on the air internationally and nationally.
My name is Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our coverage of the history-making stalemate that continues to unfold in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. President Manuel Zelaya, who re-entered the country dramatically through the mountains and walked into the capital city, remains under siege in the Brazilian embassy, where he has been given protection and refuge. The embassy continues to be surrounded by Honduran troops loyal to the coup government. In response to Zelaya's return, the coup government has attempted to institute various states of siege and emergency policies, including a dawn-to-dusk curfew, which was briefly lifted today. Well, it's back. In one moment, we'll go live inside that Brazilian embassy for a special report on what's going on. But first, we followed Flashpoint special correspondent Tim Russo through the streets of Tegucigalpa today as thousands of resistance protesters continue to march in support of Zelaya and the restoration of democracy.
This is Tim Russo in Tegucigalpa. We're following the march of the Zelaya supporters and people demanding the resignation of Roberto Mestizuriz Mestizuriz, the de facto president of Honduras. The march started at approximately 10:30 this morning at the University, the Pedagogical University of Francisco Morazan, has made its way into the center of Tegucigalpa, slowly but surely negotiating with the special police forces, the COBRAs, that are in charge of the operations here today. We are right now about one block and a half, at least ahead of the march is about a block and a half from the United Nations building here in the capital, which is about five blocks up further to the Brazilian embassy, where Manuel Zelaya continues to be holed up by a 500-meter police and military perimeter that's been established since when he arrived here on Monday. The demonstrators, Rafael Alegria from Villa Campesina and other leaders of the popular movement here, continue to negotiate with the police. Right now, there's a bit of a standoff. There hasn't been any repression as of yet, in part because the size of this demonstration or the size of this march. It's hard to say exactly how many people are here, but there are, we can safely say, are tens of thousands of people that came out despite last night's curfew, despite last night's serious conflict in many of the marginal barrios around Tegucigalpa. He spoke with an official in charge, Official Diaz, is in charge of the operation here this morning. He said there hadn't been any detentions last night, although the human rights organization says that's not the case. Right now, I'm just between a line of demonstrators, Official Diaz, and the special forces right here, just trying to cut off another splinter group that had been dispersed earlier in the day from the back of the march and is trying to regroup with the rest of the demonstration. So we have folks kind of coming out of many different streets in the center of the city. It's a bit disconcerting, I believe, for the police who have all placed their gas masks on. And again, we have two police vehicles here that have the high-power water cannon that they use mixed with some sort of burning pepper type of chemical. At this point, we're going to follow this, see if this develops, see if any sort of aggression or an attempt by the police to disperse people here takes place. Again, Official Diaz, who's in charge, has said they really didn't want to do that, but we'll have to see. That was the police line, and what we can see is that the police are still being somewhat aggressive, not this group in the front of the march, but rather those that the demonstrators pass on their way towards the United Nations building. The people do seem determined to make it to the United Nations building to have their demand heard, and we'll just have to see if that happens. This looks like it's going to be a relatively intense day. We don't know what might happen in the colonias afterwards, as many of these people came from the marginalized barrio. You can expect that if there is some sort of repression on the street here, in front of this very specific pacifist march, nonviolent march, then there probably will be skirmishes throughout the afternoon and the evening time as people begin to go back into their barrio and control their barrio. And we don't know if there may be some sort of reprisals as well at that point. So we're going to keep you up to date with how things develop here in Tegucigalpa in the center of the day, throughout the day, and we'll be in touch. Tim Russo from Tegucigalpa. Yeah, this is Tim Russo in Tegucigalpa again. Well, we're not supported. We had a standoff between the police and thousands of demonstrators that were trying to make their way to the United Nations building in the center of Tegucigalpa. After about an hour and a half in the very, very hot sun, the demonstrators began to slowly disperse, changing their route towards the center of the city, looking to go towards the Central Park, at which point the police received a rock or two that were thrown at them, not by the center of the march, but a couple of people that were straggling, and the police began to shoot tear gas into the crowd, rubber bullets into the crowd, and disperse people to get them out of that zone near the United Nations. At this point, we're on the street trying to see if the march is actually going to regroup, if they're going to regroup in the center of the city near the Congressional Building, which is two blocks from the Central Park, or if this is the end of today's organized activity. To say that we're reaching the cathedral now, I'm a little out of breath, but that's from the hills in the center of the city. And it looks like sheep will have indeed begun to regroup here. We're about 6 blocks from where the police woke up the crowd about 25 minutes ago. So it looks like people are beginning to regroup. We'll see how many people actually come back to this area at the cathedral, if they stay here or if they begin to decide this is the end of today's activities. We'll keep you posted as the day goes on, as events develop here in the city. Hopefully nothing more does take place, and hopefully things remain in calm. So we'll be following the events here in Tegucigalpa.
Was anybody hurt, Tim?
There was one man that was the very last man sort of standing in front of the police, taunting the police a little bit. The police seen that it was fit to shoot about 6 rubber bullets at him, knocking him on the ground. When he stood back up, he was knocked on the ground several other times. The police went for him, and he found the adrenaline to get off the ground and go quickly out of the area. As far as other injuries, we haven't been able to report on any other serious injuries as of yet.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Andres, are you there?
Yes, it's good to hear you, Dennis, and also to hear the report from my colleague, Tim.
Well, I'm glad that you had a chance to have a shower. Set the scene. You are still inside the Brazilian embassy, and it is still surrounded.
Exactly right. I am still here. There are some 120 others inside the embassy. It is very much surrounded. I am now at this point looking at about a platoon of both police and military. Many of them are masked. They don't want to reveal their identity. This represents a very small amount of the number of both police and soldiers who are in a 6 block area preventing anyone from approaching here. There are a few who were able to come to the embassy entrance, including Andres Pavon from the CODE, the Human Rights Committee of Honduras, the NGO. Andres Pavon was not allowed by the police to come actually into the embassy compound. The reports here with President Zelaya denouncing the widespread repression around the country by this de facto regime. President Zelaya has heard that there are some 10 who have been killed, and a number of those are disappeared, and the police are not reporting on them. The president is also denouncing attacks on the embassy itself with sophisticated technology, including high-frequency beams of energy that are being targeted towards the embassy. This is the president who has received information, and he had photographs. I was able to see photographs of very sophisticated electronic equipment that looked like huge satellite kind of contraptions very near the embassy. So it's clear that something has been going on. I can testify that I've been in the room of the ambassador's office, actually, and which is where the president spends much of his time. I spend much of the day there, and for a great period of time, there was no cell reception whatsoever. So it's very, and then all of a sudden, it does return. This is very symptomatic of the psychological warfare that's being done against the embassy, and it's been the pattern of this regime throughout the entire 88 days since the coup. And what it does is it keeps people off track. You never know when the repression will be increased, and it always keeps folks on the edge. The same has happened with turning the electricity on and off here at the embassy, or the flow of water, or allowing food and medicine in. At times it is permitted, and then at times it is blocked. Because there's no constancy, then it doesn't give a lot of validity to ongoing repression. But it's hard to document the fact that it does pull in terms of psychological warfare against those of us who feel it.
Is there now a routine developing? Is there a process? What what exactly is happening inside the embassy? How is it functioning? What role is it playing here, there, in Tegucigalpa, even as the leaders of the world gather in New York City?
It's very clear that this embassy is playing a very important role. The fact that President Lula da Silva welcomed President Zelaya here into Brazilian territory in this embassy is such a gesture of incredible support. The fact that the foreign minister of Brazil was the one who insisted that the Security Council of the United Nations meet about this urgent situation, which will take place tomorrow. This request, I'm told, was joined by both Russia and the United States. So here in the embassy, the role that this place is the function really is to host the president and detail, both his family, the security people who are with him, as well as those who have been supporting the resistance here for all of these months. And so basically one key figure here is Father Andres Tamayo, a Catholic priest who is dedicating 100% of his time to the resistance. And he, today, we opened with a circle of prayer in the embassy. And so it's basically a welcome place for the president and all of those who are able to be here, and the press. There's both international press and domestic press here. Of course, one of the most important voices in this country is Radio Globo. They are constantly reporting on the repression of this coup regime, and they serve to give a lot of information to both here in the embassy and, of course, all across the country about what is happening.
Now, Andres, can I ask you to do something for us? Maybe you can try and take the program live and introduce us to a few of the people who are there inside the embassy. Maybe there's somebody who wants to talk to the Pacifica audience here and around the country.
I would be very happy to do that, Dennis. I'm going to take you to speak with Carlos Reina is right here in front of me. He does speak English, and I'm going to ask him to give you a little bit of his perspective. And we're sitting at the table with President Zelaya at this moment. So let me hand the phone over to Carlos, and you can interview him.
Hi, Carlos. This is Dennis Bernstein. You're on Pacifica Radio on the Flashpoint Show. Welcome to America.
Well, thank you.
And we know that you two are in the Americas with us, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. How did you end up in a place like that inside the Brazilian embassy surrounded by coup soldiers? What happened?
Well, I've been doing the same question to myself. I've been working very close to the President Zelaya and his team a long time ago, because we believe in his project, and we believe that his proposal of making a new constitution for Honduras is something that is going to give us their expectations to in the future. So I've been working very close to him. The day that he announced that he was back in Honduras, we came because we're part of his team. And we stayed with him, and we're going to be here at the Embassy of Brazil until he goes, wherever he goes. If he's the president of Honduras, we're going to be with him over there. And whatever, whatever else, we also are going to be with him, because he's our leader, and he is the person that we choose to give Honduras a better future.
Tell us about what was your work? How exactly were you working with the President Zelaya? What kinds of things do you do? Tell us about your background.
Well, I've never been working at the government. I've been working in the party, in the Liberal Party of Honduras. In my family, the politics were born in the blood for more than 100 years. I had an uncle, Carlos Roberto Reina. He used to be the president of Honduras from 1994 and 1998. In that government, Presidente Zelaya was named as Minister of Social Investment. And he did such a good work over there that gave him the opportunity to run in the next term to the president. And that's why we've been close to him for a long time ago.
Let me ask you this, Carlos Reina. We know that there has been a lot of violence in the street. Some people have been killed by the security forces. We know President Zelaya is very upset about this. Have you spoken to him about it? Could you share a bit of the kinds of feelings, what's going through his mind about this stuff?
It's not surprising for us what is happening, because we know what these people are capable of. Well, remember the June 28th. They do something that we all sustained, that it was history. And they bring back that horrible history and put it again in the land of Central America. So we believe that these people, they don't know what they're doing. They're blind. And because they're blind, they don't understand. And they're doing so much so much evil to our country. And that's why the people don't like them. You know, in Honduras, 92% of the population is against the coup. 92%, and 70% of the population support President Zelaya. So we have a president that, for the first time in a long time, the poor people of Honduras, they have hope again. They hope that in this presidency and the changes that he's talking about, he can really do something to change the perspective of their lives. Because in Honduras, you have to know that when you're born in a poor family in the country, you're going to be poor in the country, and your sons are going to be poor in the country. There is no hope. But now, he, Mr. Trump, he awoke hope in people.
All right, Carlos Reina, we thank you. A friend to the president, President Zelaya, talking to us from inside the Brazilian embassy. And I guess, has the president heard from the coup government, heard from Michelete, any attempt to have a peaceful dialogue?
Well, he's calling for the dialogue. And the answer was bombs, shots, violence, repression, all that. They didn't talk. They didn't say anything. Just golpes. Just beating the people. But we hope that tomorrow, with the help of the UNO, they're going to talk about Honduras. They're going to call the Security Council of the UNO. Things are going to change.
All right, Carlos Reina,
thank you.
Thank you so much, a friend and aide.
Okay, say hello to everybody from Honduras living in California, okay?
Thank you so much for being with us. Adios. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, live inside the Brazilian embassy, surrounded by coup forces on the outside, and President Zelaya on the inside. And Andres, are you back on that telephone?
Yes, Dennis, I'm standing right here in front of the president, if you would like to greet him.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you. Welcome, President. Please say thank you for joining us. Welcome, and we appreciate your time and your courage.
Señor presidente, bienvenido y apreciamos su tiempo y su valor. Está en inglés.
Gracias y estamos siempre pendientes de la solución de este problema, sin importar el esfuerzo que haya que hacer.
Thank you so much, and we are really appreciative of your concern for this problem that we have here in Honduras, knowing that you do so out of your heart.
Mr. President, could you please share some of your concerns about the violence that has taken place against the citizens of Honduras by the military?
La violencia contra el pueblo de Honduras, la barbaridad que han cometido los
fascistas. Bueno, los que dan el golpe de Estado son simples mandaderos de una élite económica que hay en Honduras, que tiene el monopolio de las principales actividades económicas del país.
So the ones who are creating these atrocities of human rights are those who belong to an elite oligarchy who have benefited from the kinds of monopolies that have led them to have so much economic power.
And in terms of why you returned, why you walked back into the city and let the people know that you were back, what's at the core? Why did you do it?
Bueno, porque yo no renuncio a mis derechos ni al derecho del pueblo de luchar por una vida mejor para los hondureños.
It's because I, as president, do not resign as my role of president of this country, nor do I allow the people of Honduras, nor do I see the people of Honduras resigning in front of the repression that they are facing.
Mr. President, what is your plan now? What is your hope for the future?
¿Cuál es tu plan ahora, señor presidente? ¿Cuál es tu esperanza para el futuro?
Mi plan es luchar porque el régimen golpista firme el plan Arias y acepte las resoluciones de la OEA y Naciones Unidas.
My struggle now is that the golpista, the coup regime, signed the accord that was negotiated in San Jose, and that they accept the declarations that were adopted by both the United Nations and the Organization of American States. I think we have one more possibility here, Dennis.
And finally, what would you like the people of the United States, if you were speaking to the United Nations, Mr. President, what would you say?
Que las Naciones Unidas deben de dar un fuerte mensaje a la humanidad para que los golpes de Estado queden como crímenes de guerra.
My message would primarily be that the United Nations give the strong and irrevocable message that coups d'etat are crimes against humanity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President, for your time. We wish you the best of luck in the future.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Okay, great, Dennis.
All right, thank you. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That was President Manuel Zelaya speaking with our Flashpoint show from inside the Brazilian embassy inside of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He has returned to the country to restore democracy. The embassy, the Brazilian embassy, is surrounded by security forces. And so far there's been no dialogue, only, as we heard, bombs, bullets, tear gas, and the like. Andres, that was amazing. We appreciate that. That's Andres Contreras reporting from inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa. Andres, incredible work. I want to tell people you work with Democracy Now in Espanol. You are associated with Nonviolence International, and you are a longtime human rights activist, and we do appreciate the good work you're doing for the Pacifica Radio Network and for the listeners who count on a real alternative to the mainstream. So please be careful, and we will talk to you soon. Did you have a final comment, please?
I just want to say thank you, Dennis. It's an honor for me to be able to be on Flashpoints and on KPFA in general.
We thank you for being with us on Flash.
There you have it, folks. What an incredible scoop. You didn't get that on CNN. And certainly the Glenn Beck crowd is not going to be with it. This is Mike Goodell with Radio Free Kansas. See you Wednesday night. Good night.